Hey, listeners. Nancy Rommelman coming to you from Chinatown, New York City, Paloma Media Studios. I had a pretty big story come out this week in this week's issue of the Washington Examiner magazine. You can pick up a hard copy if you're anywhere in the D.C. area. It's also, of course, online. I've been talking a little bit about it online, and I decided I wanted to read it for you. So it is called A Murder in Portland. The beatings escalated after Rachel and Mo split. He would break in after midnight, the girls sleeping through his punching Rachel, choking her, telling her she was going to die. One night, he put a gun to her head. She was still shaking when the Portland, Oregon police got there and told her she could request a no contact order. When I told him I was leaving him, he told me that he would kill me, she wrote on the request, which stipulated Mo stay at least 150 feet away from her and the children. Mo ignored the no-contact order, showing up at dinner time on June 23rd. His and Rachel's four-year-old let him in. He was very high, whether on cocaine or meth, Rachel did not know. He broke her phone and blocked her way as she tried to escape. He spent hours hitting her that night, choking her five times and saying, as he knelt on her windpipe, I'm going to put you to sleep now. Mo went upstairs to the children's room. He'd left his phone on the floor. Rachel grabbed it and made for the front door. She was not wearing her abaya when the police arrived. It was 6 a.m., and Rachel had a new black eye as she told officers she believed she was going to die. Rachel's former boyfriend was charged with five counts of felony strangulation and strapped with a GPS ankle monitor. At 1:12 a.m. on July 27th, Mo was tracked to Rachel's, where he tore off his GPS. Contacted by the monitoring service, Mo claimed someone had broken into his apartment and cut off the GPS while he slept. A bench warrant was issued for his arrest. At 2 a.m. on August 11th, Mo again broke into Rachel's. A foot taller and 100 pounds heavier, he body slammed Rachel, sat on her chest, covered her mouth. She could barely breathe, but was able to scream, waking the children as Mo swung a length of prayer beads and whipped her face. Then he locked her outside. It was after 3 a.m. when police arrived and arrested Mo again. He was charged with contempt of court for violating the no-contact order. On the morning of August 27th, Mo was back. Rachel was able to get to her phone to call 911. The operator only heard her yell, "I'm not doing black magic," before the call disconnected. The operator called back. There was no answer. Mo dragged Rachel to the children's bedroom where he pressed her face to the window screen and stabbed her repeatedly with a kitchen knife, even after she went still. He moved her from the floor to a bed. He phoned his mother in Texas to tell her what he'd done. He took a shower. At 10:41 a.m., he called 911. "She's dead," he told the operator, who told him to try performing CPR. Mo refused. He said what happened was not his fault, that he had been protecting the children, that he had taken the knife out of Rachel's hand. Officers arrived at the two-story townhouse at 3221 Southeast 92nd Avenue around 11 a.m. They found three children, ages 7, 4, and 2, downstairs and took them outside. Upstairs, they saw holes in the walls and broken door locks. The carpet in a child's bedroom was soaked with blood and a sheet-covered body lay on a bed. The victim's face had been cut vertically, with a deep wound in her nose and her upper lip sliced in half. A kitchen knife without its handle was on the floor. The coroner later determined that Rachel Angel Abraham, 36, had been beaten and stabbed both before and after being strangled to death. Officers secured the scene. Muhammad Osman Adan, 33, was taken into custody. 9 miles away in Vancouver, Washington, Shay Whitaker was doing the only thing she ever did on Facebook, look at free stuff on the Buy Nothing pages. She would not have clicked the pop-up article, except she recognized the townhouse. "Does that say?" she said, handing her phone to her husband. He started to read the details, and she told him to stop, stop. Her heart was pounding in her chest, and she thought she might pass out there on the couch with her two little girls and one old dog and a husband now trying to console her. And yet part of Shay was unfortunately not shocked. Rachel had told her this was going to happen, that Mo kept telling her he was going to kill her. He'd almost killed her the last time. When was that? A week ago? Shay had told her best friend then that there was no way police would let Mo out. Not with three arrests in the past 3 months, 5 counts of strangulation, the gun to the head. But Mo had been let out. How was this possible? Shay assumed there was more than enough to have held him. Not just the recent things, but the conviction for robbery in Texas, the DUI in Minnesota. Rachel's three older girls, Elise, Amara, and Ariana, had been with their father, Mario Abraham, Rachel's first husband, since early summer. But Rachel's littlest girls with Mo, Khadijah and Zainab, she had no idea where they were. Rachel was 19 and working at a subway in Eugene, Oregon, when she and Shay met. Rachel basically became part of Shay's family, a surrogate granddaughter to Shay's own grandmother, Margaret Carter, Oregon's first black female legislature. Rachel did not have parents of her own. Her mother had signed away her rights to her children when Rachel was 10. She and her younger siblings had been fostered by this couple, Roger and Donna Manwaring. Shay thought the Manwarings had a white savior complex, until they didn't, until they drove to California while Rachel was still in high school and left no forwarding address. Rachel was staying with various friends until she moved in with Shay. The girls attended Lane Community College. They had parties. Rachel and Mario had met at one of the parties. And things were stable until Rachel's little sister Marissa showed up. The Manwarings had put her on a bus back to Eugene, no shoes and no money. So here was Rachel in charge of a 16-year-old. Marissa hooked up with a religious kid named Sevelino Capuia. Capuia kidnapped a man from a parking lot of an adult video store and shot him. He confessed to police and implicated an accomplice, Sean Ryan Womack, who, the day of Capuia's arrest, drove Marissa to the Oregon coast and shot her in the head. Her body was found on June 14, 2006. The murder was big news. Shay appeared on an Investigation Discovery TV show, The Wonderland Murders, and Rachel told a newspaper, "It is very sad that they took my sister away because all we knew and had was each other." She started instead her own family. She and Mario married and had three little girls. Rachel found work as a caregiver for the elderly, some of whom were Somali immigrants. Rachel had grown up Catholic but had never vibed with it and converted to Islam before she and Mario split. Rachel liked wearing the abaya, she told Shay. She liked the modesty. Her next two partners were Muslim Somalis. Shay had not known the first husband, the father of Rachel's 7-year-old Jasmine, but she did know Mo, whom she found unreasonably jealous. If he saw Rachel even had a text from a girlfriend, he would go ballistic. "I'm done with his ass," Rachel had texted Shay a year earlier, explaining that Mo stalked her at her caregiving jobs, that he stole her car, incidents he seemed certain would not land him in any trouble. "He's not afraid of the police," Rachel told Shay. "He's not afraid of a restraining order." The welfare of the children, no less their mother, had not seemed to matter to those in charge of keeping Mo locked up. Shay did not understand. How had Mo gotten out again? The laws dictating who would be held in jail as they awaited trial changed on July 1, 2022, with the passage of Oregon State Senate Bill 48, designed to promote consistent, fair, equitable justice practices across Oregon. SB 48 based pretrial release on a suspect's threat level and removed the state's previous cash bail system, which criminal justice reformers argued unfairly penalized the poor. Mohammed Adan was unquestionably poor when he attacked Rachel Abraham in the early summer of 2022. He was unemployed and had no permanent residence. These may have been among the reasons defense attorneys repeatedly requested Adan not be kept in custody, including on charges of felony strangulation and violating the no-contact order with Abraham. That these incidents occurred before the passage of SB 48 speaks to a certain momentum in Portland, a thrust not to burden the accused unfairly, even violent ones, as they awaited trial. The bill could have gone much further, Carl McPherson, executive director of Metropolitan Public Defender, told the Oregonian newspaper in June 2021. McPherson could not at the time have known that 1 year into the future, his firm would be asked to answer for its defense of Mohammed Adan. Mohammed Yahia worked as an advocate for the African Youth and Community Organization, ACO, which helps Somali community members navigate the legal system. Often this means helping survivors of sexual and domestic violence. But one morning, he woke up to an article on Oregon Live saying a letter he had written had helped get a man out of jail, a man who then murdered the mother of his children. The article was insinuating that without this letter, Abraham might still be alive. Mohammed Adan had been showing up at ACO all year, sometimes with his two young daughters. Adan had told Yahia he needed help fighting a DWI in another state. So Yahia, who was not yet enrolled in law school, helped him fill out a motion for default judgment. Another time, when Adan said he needed work, ICO helped him had him help deliver donated air conditioners. This past July, Adan stopped in again. He said to Yahia, "I've been volunteering for you guys for some time. Can you write me a letter of support stating that I'd volunteered?" Yahia had assumed this letter would go to his parole officer for his DWI. He wrote an anodyne note explaining about the air conditioners and that, as far as Adan's temperament, ICO had seen improvement. But Yahia now assumed Adan had given the letter to his lawyer before it ended up in the hands of the Portland Freedom Fund, which, according to Oregon Live, had bailed out Adan a week earlier. Yahia had never heard of this fund, which was now saying that his letter had given them assurance that Adan was, in quotes, a financial provider for two small children with a letter of community support. This seemed like deflection, and Yahia wondered, what purpose did it serve to make him look like an abettor and Adan like a good bet? Multnomah County District Attorney Mike Schmidt felt his office had fought hard to keep Mohammed Adan from re-victimizing Rachel Abraham. As far back as June, a criminal complaint against Adan stated that bail could be set at $60,000. In regard to the six Class C felonies against Adan, Multnomah County Deputy District Attorney Mackenzie Ludwig had written, in quotes, "There are significant lethality factors on this case, which includes potential access to firearms, increase in physical violence, and the severity of the physical violence. Victim believes offender capable of killing her," end quote. Ludwig had not prevailed. Judge Benjamin B. Johnston had let Adan out. The release agreement stating Adan must wear GPS and have no contact with Rachel Angel, Abraham, or children. This put in motion a two-month, multiple arrest odyssey that left Abraham dead and Schmidt having to address what was by then the 60th murder of the year in Portland. "Mr. Adan's intent to kill the victim was unambiguous," Schmidt said, adding how this outcome would have been obvious to anyone who bothered to look into Adan's arrest record, that you would have been hard-pressed to find a more committed and recidivist abuser. Yet Portland Freedom Fund had looked into Adan and seen things differently. Or maybe it hadn't bothered to look. Maybe it considered strangling a woman and holding a gun to her head subjacent to its work as, in quotes, "a volunteer-run abolitionist organization currently dedicated to reducing harms perpetuated against our Black, Brown, and Indigenous neighbors by the criminal justice system through posting bail so they may navigate their case from a position of freedom," as its website stated. Schmidt was not opposed to private bail funds or bail reform. Upon being elected in May 2020, he'd stood before the camera and said, "We must recognize the discriminatory practices deeply woven into the fabric of our criminal justice system. I know that together we will continue to unravel the threads of systemic racism and make our criminal justice system more equitable." The time had been right for such a sentiment, had meshed with and amplified the spirit of protest in the air, the chants of George Floyd's name and "all cops are bastards," the nightly fires and the arson at the courthouse where Schmidt himself worked. Soon after taking the job, Schmidt announced he would decline to prosecute most of those arrested during the 2020 protests, stating that his office understands the depth of emotion that motivates these demonstrations and supports those who are civically engaged through peaceful protesting. The 39-year-old Vassar College graduate wanted Portland to, in quotes, "build a stronger, smarter, safer, and more compassionate criminal justice system for all," end quote. 2 years later, the system was stumbling badly, with Portland on target to break 2021's record of 90 homicides. It wasn't as though Portland was the only mid-sized American city experiencing a rise in violent crime. Philadelphia had more than 300 murders before September. But that it was happening at all, when so many people claimed to want to do the right thing, was unsettling. It was likewise alarming that a private party had been able to do an end run around the entities charged with keeping Abraham safe. As Schmidt told the press, "Portland Freedom Fund undermined our efforts and the efforts of the court to save the victim's life by using their resources to bail him out." Kristen Olson was trying to make sense of Adan's multiple arrests and releases. A Portland litigation lawyer, she started with the first assault reported by Abraham in November 2021. More recent incidents included May 2nd, Adan punches Abraham in the head, restraining order issued. June 24th, 5 counts felony strangulation, 2 counts assault fourth degree. The criminal complaint from the DA's office suggests bail of $60,000. Jennifer List of Metropolitan Public Defender is defense attorney. June 27th, Judge Benjamin B. Johnston releases Adan, no bail. Did bail drop from $60,000 to zero, or was it never set? Olson found documents that showed a release assistance officer interviewed Adan to determine whether he was eligible for release without bail. The officer determined that Adan was, and under his own discretionary power, the officer could have released him if not for the domestic violence charges. On these, the officer would defer to the judge, who chose not to impose bail. Olson kept digging. Through Adan's repeated violations of the no-contact order, the multiple arrest warrants, the 4 judges he appeared before in a 5-week period. July 15th, Adan is arraigned, Judge Stephen Bouchon. July 26th, Adan cuts off his GPS, attacks Abraham, bench warrant issued, Judge Michael Greenleg. August 11th, Adan arrested on charges of contempt of court and other violations. August 11th, Judge Angela Lucero sets bail at $20,000. August 18th, Jennifer List, defense attorney, argues bail should be reduced from $20,000 to $1,000. Judge Jerry Hodson denies the request. August 20th, Amanda Trujillo of Portland Freedom Fund posts $2,000 bond for felony strangulations from June and the contempt violations from August. She also posts $3,000 bond for a suspended license violation in nearby Clackamas County. Olson wasn't surprised Adan had been let go again and again. The releases had ramped up after Mike Schmidt's 2020 announcement that he was not going to arrest most protesters. A local TV station had done a May through December tally of that year and found that of the over 1,000 protest-related arrests, charges were dropped more than 90% of the time. There was what Olson thought of as the bail fund piece of the puzzle, and there was the lawlessness piece. Right before the Adan murder, there had been the Kefir White murder. White, who was white, had fatally beaten an 82-year-old retired professor, Donald Pierce, at a bus stop by Portland State University. Kefir had recent arrests, including for assault, and had been let out. With Pierce's murder, a judge finally said, "No bail for that a-hole." But that's what it took, usually. It took murder. Olson found the Monday morning quarterbacking in the wake of Abraham's murder incredibly dispiriting. The district attorney's office saying the problem was Portland Freedom Fund, the fund pointing the finger at ACO. Olson had been grateful that at least some of the public was outraged and hopeful that the mission to get racial equity into the criminal justice system might be delivered some nuance, with Abraham also being black. The hope hadn't lasted. Within a week of Abraham's murder, the press had moved on, the only continued interest coming from Oregon Public Broadcasting, a spot called "Portland Freedom Fund Continues Their Mission to Help BIPOC Defendants Post Bail." That was the headline. Nothing about Abraham, nothing about her family. In all the news articles, in the Kefir White case and the Muhammad Adan case, there was never a focus on the victims. Portland isn't a dumpster fire. It's watching the sunset together. read the September 25th headline in the city's major alt weekly, commemorating an evening event spent picnicking in the park in Northwest Portland. The article neglected to mention, even in a subsequent addendum, that picnic time had coincided with a 26-year-old woman being gunned down several yards away. If the editorial omission had been innocent enough, it nevertheless came off as a "look over here, not there" stratagem, which seemed unwise, seeing as there were four homicides that weekend in the City of Roses. If for a shining season or two, Portland had presented as an exemplar of progressivism, it was now limping along, and there seemed a fundamental disconnect between Portland's public-facing entities, its media, government, and court systems, and the public at large, between those trying to push through progressive ideals and those living their consequences. The murder rate had jumped 207% since 2019. The 2020 decriminalization of drugs with little complementary implementation of drug treatment plans meant an exponential rise in the number of people shooting up and splayed out on city sidewalks. There were more than 700 homeless encampments throughout the city. More than 12,000 residents of Multnomah County left in 2020 and 2021. Home prices had recently dropped by double digits, and until the final hours, the 2022 governor's race seemed poised to tip Republican for the first time in four decades. And yet many in Portland still did not show the stomach to turn things around, hesitant to admit that an ardor for policies put in place in the heat of the moment had, in the court of public opinion, cooled significantly. If anyone had walked the walk Portlanders pledged to walk since the killing of George Floyd, and even before, it had been Amanda Trujillo. When Mohamed Adan was up for release on August 20th, who'd been there to make bail? Trujillo had been, paying the $2,000 for the charges stemming from the June and August attacks, and, while she was at it, $3,000 for a suspended license misdemeanor in nearby Clackamas County. The release papers she signed included charges of contempt violation and strangulation, but who knew if these were accurate? Bail had been set at $20,000, with only a $10,000 surety security required. Maybe whatever Adan had done wasn't that bad. That was a week ago, and what the media were now reporting, that Adan had murdered the mother of his children, was not the outcome Portland Freedom Fund had anticipated. Trujillo had not been named in initial news reports. That would change, but she'd taken heat before. That was to be expected when you fought injustice as entrenched as it was in Oregon. When Oregon Territory banned slavery in 1844, it also banned black people from living there. Consequences for those who broke this law included 39 lashes every 6 months. When Oregon became a state in 1859, its constitution forbade black people from owning property. In 1923, the Oregon Ku Klux Klan claimed 35,000 active members, more than 4% of the population. While one white woman in her 40s was not going to turn around more than a century of brutality, Trujillo wanted to do her part. Portland Freedom Fund had helped a few dozen people by the time George Floyd was killed by police, a killing that acted as an accelerant for the cause. Portland Freedom Fund now found itself awash in cash, changing its mission statement to a volunteer-run abolitionist organization currently dedicated to reducing harms perpetuated against our black, brown, and indigenous neighbors, seemed more in step with the times, and the fund grew from a tiny nonprofit organization in a Portland exurb to a player on its main stage. With more money, the fund could bail out more people, posting a total of $619,000, including $212,500 for Malik Fard Muhammad, who in the summer of 2020 built and threw Molotov cocktails at law enforcement. When Muhammad was found guilty, the fund had to forfeit that money. Plus, it would turn out a lot of other money. 39 of 67 of the fund's recipients violated their release conditions or skipped court altogether, a much higher number than the statewide average of 7%. but Trujillo kept trying. In February 2021, she started a GoFundMe that raised $9,176 of a $100,000 goal to free Portland inmates at risk of catching COVID-19. As recently as this past August, she had been able to display prisoners' release papers, held out like a fan, in photos posted on the fund's Facebook page. The page had seemed the natural place to post an offering in the wake of Abraham's murder, and the fund had written, "Our thoughts are with the families and communities affected by this tragedy, particularly the children who have effectively lost both parents. It is a profound tragedy when any person is harmed." The message had hit a wrong note. Hate comments poured in. Trujillo tried again, explaining Adan had been referred by ACO and that the fund had been in contact with Mr. Adan throughout the time between his release and rearrest and did not receive any indications for concern. Strike two. Portland Freedom Fund board member Terrence Hayes sought to clear things up during an interview on Oregon Public Broadcasting. Hayes, who was Black, agreed that Abraham's murder was horrific. And yet the fund had received a recommendation from Adan's lawyer and the judge had granted bail. And as far as he was concerned, the media and the DA's office and for everybody to attempt to focus this, make Portland Freedom Fund a problem in a problematic system is just, it's ludicrous. The public nonetheless aimed its rage and sorrow at Portland Freedom Fund. A change.org petition gathered more than 1,200 signatures. Among its demands that the fund issue an immediate apology acknowledging your role in the bail release of Muhammad Adan. Threads on Lipstick Alley and Reddit read, respectively, "I'm not even shocked. Black women and children are just fodder for these pathetic males and their so-called social justice organizations. And this is why no Black woman or woman of color should be a liberal feminist. They protect minority men more than they do so for us." Within days, the fund's social media platforms were overwhelmed with accusations and reprobation, and it seemed wise to scrub its online presence, to delete Twitter and Instagram and PortlandFreedomFund.org and finally Facebook, which for so long had been a repository of support and even love. What was that phrase? You go bankrupt slowly, then all at once? Still, the speed with which one could become a pariah was petrifying, and Trujillo made a point of not returning calls, not answering emails, not going outside when reporters turned up at her door, reporters who soon stopped turning up at all. Sharia Mayfield knew Rachel Abraham as someone who did henna for other Muslim women. She knew her as a sensitive, sweet, soft-spoken mother who'd been trying to escape domestic violence for some time. A law professor and anti-discrimination attorney who'd unsuccessfully run for Multnomah County chairwoman in May 2022, Mayfield had long pondered legal solutions to the problem of domestic violence. The county, and especially Portland, prided itself on its supposedly progressive politics, claiming to protect the most vulnerable. Yet the city had seen record increases in gun violence, homicides, and other crime, largely affecting minority communities, women, and children. Abraham, whom Mayfield knew by her Muslim name Jamila, meaning beauty, was another example of a woman who took every reasonable step to protect herself, and still, the so-called justice system let a repeat offender with high lethality factors out again to finish off his victim. It bewildered Mayfield that even after Adan broke a no-contact order, he was allowed the option of bail. While Schmidt had told the Oregonian, "Our prosecutors in June aggressively pursued a high bail amount in this case," $60,000 was not really high, not when only a 10% surety was required, or, as it turned out, not required. No judge had set bail until August, and then it was only $20,000, a veritable golden opportunity for an unregulated private bail fund to show its bona fides by writing a $2,000 check, one that led directly to murder. The details showed Portland to be a place that centered a male abuser over a female victim, that prioritized his comfort over her safety. This was not progressive. It was regressive, exposing a mother and now her children to an inverted justice system where even the most violent repeat offenders are given the freedom to kill. Mayfield believed real reform meant changing local court rules and legislation to ensure that violent people with repeat domestic convictions were detained and denied bail. For starters, anyone accused of violence who removed a GPS tracker must be denied bail, especially when they immediately returned to attack their victim, as Adan had done. And yet Portland's system of justice allowed these people a get-out-of-jail-free card from bail funds, such as Portland Freedom Fund, which, now that it had performed exactly as represented, was seen as the bad guy. It would be hilarious if it were not so absolutely tragic. The circular firing squad that had become the district attorney's office and Portland Freedom Fund, and ideologues who for the past 2 years had been okay with setting the Malik Fard Muhammads of the world free, who made poster boys of killers and would-be killers. It was lunacy. How long would Portland keep falling for the upside-down world? How long before it became clear people must extend a significantly larger amount of empathy to people like Rachel rather than people like her murderer? A Talmudic saying had been on Mayfield's mind: kindness to the cruel leads to cruelty to the kind. In Multnomah County, she saw this on full display. And everyone who was outraged by the shielding of abusers must, she believed, commit to pushing for change and holding bad actors accountable. Otherwise, more people like Rachel would be the collateral damage. The murder of George Floyd had brought thousands of Portlanders to the street, screaming his name, screaming for justice. No one shouted Rachel Abraham's name. She did not become a campaign topic or talking point. Beyond a small GoFundMe started by ex-husband Mario Abraham to cover funeral costs, there was no outpouring of financial support for her children. Instead, Abraham became a statistic, remembered as 2022 Portland homicide victim number 60, if she was remembered at all. Maybe the city had empathy exhaustion. Maybe a domestic violence murder, one in which both parties were black, did not pack the right amount of political heat, did not fit comfortably into the narrative of contemporary heroes and villains. It was also nearly unspeakably sad, a mother being slain in the next room or the same room as her children, just too much to bear. Beyond its initial statement, the district attorney's office would not talk about Abraham. Asked about the peculiarities of the bail jumps, Judge Jerry Hodson answered, "I do not believe it is appropriate for me to comment on pending cases." Metropolitan Public Defender, whose lawyers defended Adan both before and after he murdered Abraham, did not respond to emails, and when reached by phone, said only, "We're actually not going to be making any comment on that, thank you," before hanging up. The central question asked by those closest to Abraham and others, "How did this happen?" turned out to have a simple answer. Muhammad Adan was released from jail because that's what the people of Portland said they wanted. They demanded, during their 100-plus nights of protests, a different kind of justice, one that would curtail or eliminate the carceral system. They set the courthouse on fire, literally and figuratively. They elected people and enacted laws that would take power from traditional authorities, the police, the courts, because they believed those authorities could not be trusted. Only the people, it was proffered, could be trusted to do the right thing. That the people could not be trusted to do the right thing. That Portland Freedom Fund had effectively removed the protections keeping Abraham alive might have given people pause. Might have had them questioning whether a murdered mother of six was an acceptable loss on the road to criminal justice reform. Too late. The lenient sentencing people demanded now carried justice in unpredictable directions. Officials who'd previously said the things citizens were listening for, that they would not jail people for nonviolent crime, began to see that the definition of nonviolent was open to interpretation, that the nature of criminality is not fixed. If the voters of Portland wanted to know whose actions, in addition to Muhammad Adan's, had enabled the murder of Rachel Abraham, they might start by looking in the mirror. Man, that's a bit tough for me to read, especially at the end there. I thank you so much for listening. There are going to be links here, obviously, to the article, so you can read it if you'd like to. and also to a piece that I wrote, a complimentary piece that I wrote on my Substack, sort of giving context to how Portland really finds itself in the position where Rachel Abraham, where it became so easy to attack and reattack her and then murder her. Okay, thanks everyone for listening again. Bye-bye.